Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and I can't wait for the sequel to this movie, Godzilla Divided by Kong, and its sequel, Godzilla Factorial. Joining me today is Devinder Hardawar.
Spoiler, Godzilla and Kong don't even kiss. I was expecting, I was promised a new empire, folks. I got nothing.
And Jeff Cannata.
The X may be silent, but I refuse to be.
Those are all vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, or if you're the director, Adam Wingard, you're supposed to pronounce it with the X silently, just Godzilla Kong, The New Empire. I can't do it, guys. I can't bring myself to do it. I'm sorry.
No, it shan't be done.
It's okay. We will never have to talk about this movie again. So it's okay after this one.
It's a good thing the movie wasn't a massive success at the box office this weekend. But anyway, yes, that is going to be our main review. Of course, before that, we got some what we've been watching for you, a bunch of new stuff to talk about, and some weekly plugs before we get to our review. You can find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Find us on YouTube and on Instagram at thefilmcastpod. We're also on TikTok at thefilmcast. And if you want to support this podcast, you can become a patron at patreon.com/filmpodcast. Where you can sign up for ad-free episodes and exclusive After Darks. Now, we got a bunch of cool stuff coming up in the After Dark for you in the near future. You know, last week on the podcast, Devinder Hardawar and Jeff brought up the movie Molly and Max in the Future. Molly and Max in the Future, which is a small indie film that's streaming right now on video on demand. You can rent or buy it.
And when we brought it up, I recall you saying, I commit to watching that movie before next week's podcast.
Yeah. Well, because Jeff Cannata said, David, I'm 100% sure you will not like this movie.
That's right.
And, you know, Jeff can recommend me stuff all day long. I'm not going to listen to him. But if he says, if he makes a statement about what I will or will not like, I must prove him wrong. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So
And yet you failed. So,
yeah.
Okay, hold on, guys. Wow. Hold on. Okay. So the current plan is for us to discuss Molly and Max in the Future on the After Dark this week. All right. So if you want to.
Which you have not yet seen.
It was on my to-do list for today, Jeff.
For today.
Not yet done.
Because I knew that we would do an After Dark about it. I knew that was very possible. Okay. So, all right. And as for next week's After Dark, or actually, not next week necessarily, but in the next couple weeks, we're going to be doing After Dark. That was prompted by this email that comes in from Chris, who became a Money Horse patron over at patreon.com/filmpodcast. Chris writes in to /filmcast@gmail.com, quote, I come to you as a loyal listener of the Filmcast for over 13 years. My brother, Tim Smith, and his girlfriend and partner, Arkasha Stevenson, made the film The First Omen. They both co-wrote the film. Tim produced it. Arkasha directed it. So I humbly ask, no beg, for you to make The First Omen your main review. And then Tim goes on into a very kind of lengthy explanation of why this is important to him. He says, quote, my family grew up loving movies and especially horror movies. I have an older brother, Tim, and younger sister, and going to the movies and making home movies was a way of life. My older brother and I love horror and trace this back to our uncle showing us The Lost Boys when we were in preschool. My uncle was babysitting us and didn't have kids, so he was oblivious to the fact that we probably should not have been watching a movie like that at our age.
Perhaps not.
Either way, we were hooked. My brother and I dressed up as Dracula for Halloween at my Christian preschool. Watching Evil Dead 2 and Halloween were a tradition for my family. It was a common occurrence for our family to find ways to use the line, we were expecting more from the movie Waxwork. We were the family that would go to Orlando to go to Universal Studios, not Disney World. One of our homemade movies was The Closet, the story of a dummy who tried to kill my sister. Fast forwarding, my brother introduced me to slashfilm.com and the /filmcast as we were both wrapping up high school. Our passion
for movies. The story of three dummies who try to entertain your sister.
Our passion for movies and filmmaking was only increasing, and your podcast was the perfect vehicle to enhance our love of exploring and discussing movies. It has been a weekly bonding moment talking about the /filmcast, now Filmcast, for the past 13 years. But the impact didn't stop there. I met the love of my life bonding over our love of the HBO series Game of Thrones on our very first date. I recommended A Cast of Kings on this first date, and now my now wife listened almost immediately after, and it was a driving force in us texting back and forth as we got to know each other. Fast forward to 7 years of dating, which includes 5 years of marriage. We look forward to watching Love is Blind to enjoy the show together, but more so to listen to the Decoding Reality podcast together, podcast that I, David Chen, do with my wife. The Filmcast introduced me to DLC, something I bond over with my gaming friends, and use the intro as a general pump-up song in life. I started reading Engadget for tech reviews because of the Filmcast. Devendra can take credit for saving me money on things I don't buy based on his review guidance, like the Apple Vision Pro.
This guy's really leaning on thick.
Really? Man.
The list goes on. Three people I have never met are strangely a part of my regular life. Anyway, he goes on to talk about why the movie's great and so on. But obviously, we've impacted his and his family's life and helped to shape the course of events. So thank you to Chris for writing in that email to /filmcast@gmail.com. Now, here's the thing, Chris.
Yeah, unfortunately, we cannot.
Unfortunately, this is it.
If you had only liked one more of our things.
Unfortunately,
I have like a couple of podcasts you didn't mention, Chris.
Unfortunately, if you had just shouted out "We have concerns," it would have tipped us over the edge.
Subscribe to all our channels.
Put it right over the top, but no, couldn't be bothered to listen to "We Have Concerns," I guess, huh?
Chris, we thank you for the heartfelt email. So here's what we're gonna do: something that we wouldn't have otherwise done if it wasn't for the email, which is we're going to make the first Omen one of our After Dark reviews over the course of the next week or two. I'll be traveling in the next week, and so I might not be able to get to. And by the way, this is probably only going to be a me and Devendra watch it joint, and then Jeff listens in on the conversation.
Yeah.
Just because Jeff doesn't like the horror movies that much. But
we'll get him there.
We are Devendra and I were deeply moved by your heartfelt email. Jeff does not give a shit. He could not
I'm still
be
sore about that whole other podcast thing.
But we will be watching The First Omen over the course of the next couple weeks and doing an After Dark review of The First Omen. I will say I have never seen The Omen, which is a huge sort of blind spot for me, but
Not that huge.
Devendra has, and so it's going to be...
You're talking about The First Omen.
The first film. The film called The Omen,
Jeff.
Right. Not The First Omen.
Not the new film called The First Omen.
The remake of The Omen starring Liev Schreiber. Okay, that's another new Omen. Okay.
Yeah. So many omens. Anyway,
I saw that in theaters. Man.
Congratulations to Chris and to Tim and to his partner, Arkosh Stevenson, for The First Omen being a wide release movie. That's
huge,
awesome.
Huge congratulations. That's great. And what an awesome email. What a lovely thing to say.
Yeah, it is so difficult to have a movie made and to get it out in theaters these days. So
I do want to say shout out to also one of the best trailers I've seen. It does this like creepy backwards filming thing, which I found really effective. Mm. It also is playing in theaters at the same time as the Immaculate trailer, which is the other like religion gone bad type of thing. And it is wild. It is wild. We've got two of those movies and it's Easter. So, you know, that's how we're all celebrating.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that very lovely email. And yeah, so we will be talking about The First Omen on an After Dark this week. And because Chris is a Money Horse patron, he will have access to that episode along with 3,000 other plus patrons at patreon.com/filmpodcast. Join them today, support this podcast, and help to keep it going.
Hey, Dave, can I do a quick anecdote real quick that you reminded me of, or his email reminded
sure.
me of?
Sure, let's go. Let's go.
I recent transplant here to Denver, Colorado, and our kids are in schools now, and so we're kind of insinuating ourselves into a completely new social structure, a new neighborhood, a new new friends, new social interactions, as one does when one's kids are in school. You tend to hang out with parents
and only
the
parents.
Kids in your class,
yeah,
and. I was recently at a little get together, talking to other dads and a couple of guys that I really like. And we're kind of getting to know each other a little bit. And one dad let it slip, you know, we kind of got into nerdy topics, and one dad let it slip that he was a huge fan of Game of Thrones, read the books, loved the show. And he's like, yeah, I even listened to this podcast about it. Every week. And hey, by the way,
I debased myself to listen to a podcast. I know. Would you believe it?
It's so embarrassing. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. embarrassing. No concept. I mean, he kind of knew what I did mm-hmm. for a living, mm-hmm. what I do for a living, but like didn't no real concept of it, no access point to it. Right. I'm like, oh, really? Which Game of Thrones podcast do you listen to? And he's like, I can't remember the name of it. I think it was like a cast of kings. And I was like, I know those people. Like the guy from that show is on my podcast. And so now I have like total cachet with this dude. He's like, that's cool. That's what you do. That's you know that. So
you got us one more listener, Jeff. Good job.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, I don't know if he actually is going to go so far as to listen to our show.
Yeah.
But one time in my life, knowing Dave Chen was a positive for me.
Another thing this email is just making me think of, like, listen, folks, if you listen to us devotedly for a decade and you happen to make a wide release movie, maybe we will sort of review it. Okay. Yeah. Maybe it'll happen.
A portion of us will actually.
A portion of us will be moved to review it.
But congratulations.
Cool. Congrats. Yeah, very cool. That's always a thing where sometimes I'll meet people out in the world that listen to some of my stuff. And I'm always, it's a kind of a weird thing, not just like the parasocial component of it, which we all know what that is, but I think it's more like depending on how many episodes you've listened to, your knowledge of me may vary dramatically. You know what I mean? So it's like, you either know a lot about me or you know potentially almost nothing about me. You know, like if you listen to only like 20 episodes, you know almost nothing about me. If you've listened to 600 episodes, you know quite a bit about me, you know? Yeah. And so it's like, I'm not going to ask. I'm not going to be like, how many episodes have you listened to, buddy? You know, like, that's awkward. But that's the new thing I'm struggling with is when I meet someone out in the wild who's listened and I'm like, how many, you know, okay, what does that mean? You know,
I'm just going to be really Werner Herzog here. Come to accept that we will never know anybody. How about that? Never truly know anybody.
Life in we all die alone, right? Like, that's kind of... like when you fall in love, best case scenario, you die at the same time. That's the best case scenario, right?
So. Have you ever been hanging out with somebody that listens to some or portion?
Yes.
Then you like you find yourself telling a story that you have told on the show on a show, and then you feel like an idiot because they already knew the story. You know,
I actually this guy only has one story.
Yeah,
he tells it over and over again.
I'm a one trick pony over here.
I actually, this is what happens to me is some of my friends listen to the stuff that I do and they will comment on it and they'll say, I heard about the time when you, fell over and broke your nose because of a stupid thing you did, David Chen. And, you know, that's a fake thing that didn't actually happen. But
sure.
Great story though.
thank you, Jeff. And, I will say I'll be grateful. I'll be grateful that they have heard the story through the podcast because then I don't need to repeat it. You know, what I mean? Like then I don't need to do that.
Dave
again.
Walks but around with stuff. Dave walks around with an MP3 player and he's like, I don't want to just listen to me
just
talk.
Just listen to this.
I don't. Yeah. I'm gonna sit in silence while you listen to me talk.
When you do that, you need new material though for the conversation. Your conversation bank is spent.
That's
so
true.
So then what happens? Their lives.
First of all, I have other things to talk about. Okay. But also, guys, I'm telling you is I'm trying to min-max the efficiency of the conversations I have in person. You know, since I spend so much time recording the conversations. It's like
you must be so tired of people asking you what's Jeff Cannata really like.
It is exhausting.
Yeah.
Because it happened one time in the last 10 years, and even that was too much. So
I'm still sweating.
All right. Anyway, keep those emails coming in to /filmcast@gmail.com. And thank you so much. And congrats on the first Omen. We'll be checking it out on the After Dark in the next couple weeks.
One quick additional thing. Saw a video that maybe you guys had seen. I don't think it's recent. I think it's quite old. But I had never seen it before, and it blew my mind. The guy, and I should know his name off the top of my head. I do not. The guy who played Biff in the Back to the Future trilogy.
Tom Wilson.
Yep. Yes. Seems like a really smart, fun guy. There's a clip of him that I just saw on TikTok that of him doing a live stage performance of a song he wrote.
Yes.
Where he's answering all the questions that he incessantly gets
from
the same question over and over and over. And it's very entertaining. If anybody has not seen that, I highly recommend it.
It's very old and it's kind of like the internet is cyclical, you know, like the same things go viral like every 5 years.
I don't know how I missed this one because it looks like he was done in the 90s or something. Mm-hmm. It's quite old, but very funny. Him, you know, the song is him answering, you know, what's What's Michael J. Fox really like? You know, did you actually fall in real manure? And all these, like, the questions he always gets. It's very funny.
Just Google Biff's question song, and you'll find that song. But basically, Jeff, I think you're saying we need one of those, you know?
Well, you do.
All right. Anyway, thanks for the emails to slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with what we've been watching right after this. All right, folks. The three of us have a text thread, an iMessage thread on our iPhones, and we text each other on occasion with some news or some reactions or discussion of logistics. And this week, Devendra texted the following message to the textual thread. We found a new Dave joint.
I knew it from
and
the start.
And then
all
proceeds.
I needed was the title, by the way. I hadn't heard anything about the movie.
Right.
Nothing else. Just the title.
He links to this article at Variety reviewing a new documentary called Sperm World. The headline of the article is Sperm World Documentary Introduces the Sperm Kings, who use Facebook to donate to dozens or hundreds of women. I know some people listen to this podcast with their kids around, so you may want to ask them to tune out for this next segment of the podcast.
If you have not had that talk yet, yes.
All right. So, you know, guys, often doing this podcast is an exercise in isolation and loneliness, but every now and then, I do feel seen by the folks in this podcast. And this was one of those cases where Devendra just peered right in my soul. He's like, Dave Chen, he's going to love this documentary.
I mean, I remember the Penis Museum, you know?
Yes. Yeah. There's a documentary called The Final Member, the Penis Museum, about a penis museum in, I want to say, Iceland? Yeah, I think that's right. Anyway, solid movie. Sperm World. This is a documentary that's put out by the New York Times, and it's on FX on Hulu. It is made by director Lance Oppenheim, who made another documentary that I quite enjoyed a while back called Some Kind of Heaven, which is about the villages.
You would classify this documentary as an Oppenheimer?
Wow. Really, really set up there for you, Jeff.
What is going on with you today, man? That's not even...
It's pretty...
I held back the other joke that I was going to say, which was like, that's how you know, Greenland is ice and Iceland is penis museums.
Wow.
That's a handy mnemonic there.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
He's and school kids.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's made by Oppenheim.
It's made by Lance Oppenheim. Now, here's the thing about Lance Oppenheim is I am convinced that Lance Oppenheim, very talented director, I am convinced he hates the fact that he makes documentaries. because basically, like, documentaries mostly have a very specific aesthetic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and people can like play around with it, you know, like people can like have variations on it, but like you kind of know what a documentary looks like. Like most of the time when you're watching a documentary, you kind of know what it looks like. Sometimes, you know, I remember the documentary Amy, very, very powerful documentary about Amy Winehouse. That movie used no talking heads and it was just archival footage of Amy Winehouse or like personal behind the scenes footage of Amy Winehouse. And there's like voiceover overlaid on top of it. And that was like the whole movie. Very powerful, very well done. So I'm saying like there can be variations on the formula, but most of the time you know what it's like. Okay, we're doing reenactments or we have the camera right there and as the thing is happening or we're doing talking head interviews or whatever. Like you kind of know what a documentary looks like. Lance Oppenheim's movies do not look like that. All the stuff that you think would go into a regular movie, like extreme color grading or interesting compositions, use of like people being out of focus and depth of field and all this stuff. He's doing all that stuff. He's making his movies as cinematic as possible. He's making them look as interesting as possible, literally to a fault, to a point where it's actually like actively irritating. Like it's kind of like, okay, guy, just tone it down a little bit with the stylistic flourish. Who do you think you're reaching here? I am like a hardcore documentary watcher fan. And you know, this is a little too much for me, you know? But aside from that, like the movie is very beautiful and there's a really interesting decisions and compositions. But it's just stylistically, it's fascinating the decisions he makes. And there, it's like this. It's sometimes we watch a movie, guys, and we're like, decisions were made, you know, like, and some of them are good and some of them are bad. And this is one of those movies where it's like, decisions were made. Okay. That's the movie, the filmmaking style. Let's talk about the actual substance of the documentary. So what Sperm World is about is there are guys who gather on these online Facebook groups. These Facebook groups of people who are trying to conceive, right? And they're looking for sperm donors. And there are guys who they love doing this.
They just love helping.
They love help. Yeah, they love helping. And so they'll just go on and give their sperm away, right? On these sperm groups. And there's often there's nothing sexual happens, right? They provide a sample in a medical container or whatever to these people, and then the person then uses it to inseminate themselves. So it's not sketchy in that specific way. But what this documentary does is it follows three people who are really active on this group. And I have to say, I left the documentary feeling very upset, like that these people are out there. And
when you say very active, like the very active, this is not a forum, you know, or this is not like a social media network that you want to hear people being like a highest poster. That's not just kind of gross.
There is one guy.
Is there like a kink around, or maybe kink is the wrong word, but is there a compulsion around trying to father as many children as possible?
Like that is the question that the documentary asks is, what is driving these people? There is one guy in this documentary who has over 100 children and literally doesn't, I believe he's literally homeless. He just travels around the country visiting these children for like a week at a time or a few days at a time, and sleeping on people's couches, and the women are generally very receptive because he helped them to give them a child. So
this guy is a genius.
They can crash on,
like, clearly you got a couch in every town to crash on. It's amazing.
I got
figured it all out.
I got a port in every town.
Well, that's the thing is. There's almost this kind of thing where it feels like, I don't know, kind of some of the better aspects of fatherhood without the responsibility of it, right? Like,
sure.
You go, you visit, you play with the kids, and then you have no attachment. You can just, no string. You can just cut bait and flee and go to another country.
Yeah, no, I'm sure the kids love that.
In fact, this has been a concept among disappearing fathers forever, right? It's not a new thing. But I think they have perfected the act of it.
That's just called being an uncle. That's,
I mean,
you guys trying
term,
to be an uncle by being a father. That's not right.
We've got the term Rolling Stone, you know, like this has been a thing.
Cats in the Cradle and Silver Spoon. Mm-hmm.
I think that I left this on the one hand, it's like, okay, a lot of people don't like using sperm banks because it's expensive. Sometimes they think sperm banks are scams or poorly run. And some people like to meet the donor. And so in steps this opportunity of connecting via Facebook, and then you can meet in person and kind of work it out, and people can have a good reputation in the Facebook group and so on and so forth. It's a fascinating look at the subculture. It left me deeply troubled. Because you don't come away
movie.
You don't come away from this documentary thinking, yeah, everyone here is really everyone's winning here. Like,
we need a sequel documentary in like 16 years, right? Talk to the kids, be like,
right,
did you know?
Yeah. That's the thing. They don't really interview the moms. They don't interview the kids. It's just the dudes. So that's a big sort of downside.
Sure,
of this
it's a win for them. Yeah,
right. I'm sure they're living life and loving it. It's a kind of psychological profile of the kind of guy that would do this thing. And in an ideal world, everyone wins. In a non-ideal world, it's like, you know, it's I think people will end up getting hurt in this equation, you know, at some point.
The sequel documentary should be called Spawn World and should be made in 15 years.
Sperm World and Spawn World.
Yeah.
I thought Jeff, you were going to go with Sperm Galaxy.
Yeah. Jeff, what were you going to say? You were going to say something? Or?
There's nothing that would make me want to watch this movie. Nothing. There's zero part of me that And I'm glad it is to your delight and serves your very, very specific interests. But my goodness, there's no.
I just feel like it's complicated. Like the legal protections for the kids and everything. Like, could there's nothing stopping these moms from being like, well, now you owe child support or something. Like, this was a story in right, New York City.
They don't go into any of that in the documentary, but it mm-hmm. feels like it's kind of like an honor system. It feels like it's kind of like,
that's kind of what it is.
You give us a sperm for free and we will not make this bad for your life in some way. Basically.
There was a big story right. in the New York Times, like the local Target in Brooklyn, a guy would go in the bathroom there and just exchange sperm. And that was his thing. One guy, Target bathroom. Next time you go into the Target bathroom, think about what happens in there. But that was the story. And that's the Target I always go to. And I'm like, that is a weird thing to be doing. But a lot of people needed his juice.
You want to do this in a public place because.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can tell, but like maybe some of these people are kind of sketchy. So you don't want to be doing this in like a back alley somewhere. You want to do it in a public place where there might be witnesses in case something.
You want to exchange sperm from a stranger in a public space. You don't want to do anything dangerous.
Absolutely.
I don't know anything about anything, but can you just walk into a doctor's office and be like, here's the sperm I want to use?
No. They don't do it in a doctor's office. They like do it manually using like a syringe.
Like, taste it, buddy.
Oh,
yeah.
My.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
That's a DIY.
Jeff, here's my takeaway. You have a lot to learn before you get on these sperm donor
groups. Jeff, it's like, how is Bobby formed?
I was signing up right now, and I guess I got to hold off.
Jeff is wondering, how were kids made? I don't know.
No idea. I don't know how mine
got
made.
You have two of them now. Huh.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Anyway, I think it's interesting. I think it's missing a lot of information, mm-hmm, and I think that's because the director is more interested in making something cinematic than something informative. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But it's a beautiful looking movie. There's some really interesting shots in it, and
so to speak.
And the characters / people, the subjects are very compelling. So I would actually recommend it if anything that I have said sounds remotely appealing to you, go check out the documentary Sperm World, which is available right now on Hulu and FX. So that is one thing I've been watching this week.
Sure.
As if thematically linked, Devendra is up next.
I am up next. I'm just going to take that baton. It's going to run with it here.
Take that syringe.
That baster. I have seen Jonathan Glazer's 2004 film, Birth. And I've heard about this film for a while because it's one, the concept of it is just pretty wild. And I remember people making fun of it for a while.
I've been meaning to watch this one because I've been meaning to catch up on, I think it's the only Jonathan Glazer movie I haven't watched.
Same. That is exactly why I watch it. And I love Jonathan Glazer at this point. So I'm like, yes, I'm all for it. This movie is incredible. I think it is right up your alley, Dave. I'm not sure. I almost want to dare Jeff to dive into this movie because what the pitch of it, which you've all probably heard by this point, it stars Nicole Kidman. She's introduced to this young boy. He presents himself to her. He says, I'm your dead husband. I'm 10 years old. I'm the reborn entity. I'm the reincarnated form of your dead husband. Go movie. You know, this movie is fascinating in an almost like a Kubrick way. It actually feels very thematically similar to something like Eyes Wide Shut, even because it's set in New York, like really rich, upper crusty New York. But then there's something weird going on. And it's sort of like how this idea, if a kid just came up to you and said they were your dead partner and then had all this like proof, had all this like knowledge of things that happened that were never told to other people. At what point do you start to be like, what if? Because nobody else knows this. How do they know this? Maybe the universe doesn't work the way we think it does. It is a fascinating exploration of like how that idea kind of affects people, and especially Nicole Kidman's character, who is somebody who is about to be remarried. She's in a new relationship with the fiance, played by Danny Houston. Love Danny Houston. The entire cast of this movie is fantastic. Like Lauren Bacall also plays her mother. But like she's about to be married to this new person, but she still has guilt over her dead partner. And it's really a movie about guilt. It's a movie about somebody who can't really let go from a past relationship that was just kind of like left abruptly. She couldn't really put the finishing touches on that. And it's about a woman who's going through a lot. So in addition to the grief in addition to the new wedding. Now there's this kid who's like, I'm your dead husband. And it's just fascinating. Like, I think what I love about Jonathan Glazer's movies, especially Under the Skin and Zone of Interest, is that they are so very observational. I think maybe to their detriment sometimes. I remember you really didn't like that aspect of Zone of Interest, Jeff.
Yeah.
But he does a good job of just like hanging back, letting the camera play, and letting the actors really like give their all to a scene. There's a virtuoso shot in this movie where there's a moment where Nicole Kidman's character just starts to have a realization of like, what if this is true? And the camera is just on her face for like 2 minutes. And you see her like going through all these emotions, and Wagner is playing in the background. It's just so beautiful and thematic. I think this is my favorite kind of thriller where you're just watching people interact and then something really weird is happening. It's about people genuinely treating that possibility real and having genuine emotions around it. Kind of reminds me of May December, I think. It's even kind of funny at times, even though the subject matter is kind of weird. And there are really like disturbing scenes. There's a scene, this is talked about, so not a huge spoiler, but there's a scene where, you know, a kiss happens. There's a scene where the little boy is in the bathtub with her. And people have talked about this and how disturbing it is for a while. But then you watch it, and it's just kind of fascinating seeing how people react to a very strange situation. It's also incredibly well made. Like, this movie opens with a very long Steadicam shot, which I believe was even shot by the guy who essentially invented the idea of the Steadicam, like Kubrick's guy from The Shining. It has a lot of those vibes. It's just so fascinating, so well acted. I'll never get this movie out of my head. So if you're like me and you've been thinking about watching Birth for a while, go watch Birth. It's great. It's on the Criterion Channel right now. I'm sure you could stream it on video on demand as well. I think it's on Prime Video. So yeah, definitely worth checking out. On a related note, I also saw Jonathan Glazer's. There's a short he did before Zone of Interest called The Fall. And he made this in 2019. This is just a really like a really short glimpse of like a fascistic society going through some sort of ritual. And that thing was also fascinating to watch. So
how did you see that movie?
The short is on Criterion right now. And I believe you could just
I think it's on his website. Yeah, it's on his website. Yeah.
It's okay, on his website. It may be on YouTube too. It is a fascinating experiment to see, especially also having seen Zone of Interest, because it is like dealing with the same themes, but also he is such a unique filmmaker where like he will just like go for ideas. Like that short will sometimes just linger on a shot for like a couple of minutes. It's like, you've got 6 minutes to work with here, buddy. And you're spending all this time on that, but there is meaning in that. And I think there's a lot of that in Birth too. Like there's very deliberate filmmaking. It's all just really fascinating. It's incredibly well written. The child actor to tell the story, you also have to have a child actor who's like, I think, compelling and believable as like the soul of an adult. And I think Cameron Bright does that really well too. So this movie is just phenomenal, and we should definitely be talking about it more. So that's Birth.
Birth is on Criterion. And yeah, I've been meaning to check it out, obviously, with all the Jonathan Glazer acclaim that's been happening recently. Mm-hmm. I'm Under the Skin, one of my favorite movies of that decade.
Sexy Beast is great. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a Sexy Beast TV series now. I don't know if you're aware. Mm-hmm. So Jonathan Glazer definitely having a moment. But Birth, available right now on Criterion. It is something that I plan to check out very soon. Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you've been watching this week.
Well, from Sperm World to Birth, now to an entire life. Our theme continues this week. I watched a documentary as well this week, very differently toned. Steve Martin, a documentary in two pieces, debuted on Apple TV Plus, and I watched both of these pieces, each of them full feature length. And very different. This is the one of the coolest things I think about this project. I'm a huge Steve Martin fan. I think the guy is one of the few legitimate geniuses in the world. A polymath. Just it seems to have boundless artistic expression. I mean, he's one of the world's greatest banjo players. He's a playwright. He's a cartoonist. He's an art collector, just a brilliant, brilliant human being. And to have this comprehensive two-part documentary with his full cooperation and participation hit Apple TV Plus, I pounced on it. And as I said, the structure is really cool. So I imagine there is a large portion of our audience, probably most of our audience, that doesn't have any real sense of Steve Martin's origins. The fact that he was the biggest stand-up comedian of all time, the first stand-up comedian to play stadiums. He was the biggest star to ever, ever do it, to do stand-up comedy. At that time, in the late 70s, nobody had the draw Steve Martin had. He absolutely changed what it was to be a stand-up comedian. And all of that, before, I think you guys weren't even born yet, before most of the people listening to this podcast probably were born. In 1980, he quit. He was at the top of the food chain. He was completely dominating, playing stadiums. He could sell out tens of thousands of seats, venues, and he just stopped. He just quit. And that is the time period that the first part of this documentary, the first segment of this documentary, covers. And it does so with a just staggering amount of archival footage, footage of from Martin's own libraries, I'm guessing his own, you know, his own archives of his youth, his family life. There's like home movies. There's his earliest performances. There's tons of stand-up footage of him, his appearances on, The Tonight Show. Early stuff, his figuring stuff out, home recordings of him testing out stand-up bits and rehearsing in front of the mirror, like an incredible amount of access to never before seen footage of him in his earliest period. And it's incredible. It's so amazing to watch this thing come to fruition. And if you know anything about Steve Martin's stand-up, it was this very avant-garde, bizarre, wild and crazy guy, him with kind of crazy props and pushing the envelope and kind of doing this anti-comedy that was nobody had ever done anything like it on the scale that he did it. And to learn how intentional that was, how crafted that was, and how much resistance he got to it initially, like, he didn't just become this massive star overnight. There was a lot of failure because he was doing something nobody had done before. And he was actively undermining the established patterns and rhythms that people were used to with stand-up comedy. And you see him work through that. You see his self-doubt through it, the challenges he was going through. He was keeping a journal at that time. They show lots of excerpts of that journal. It's an amazingly insightful and open look at the creative process of somebody that is inventing something completely new. Rare to see that, I think, and really awesome. And again, it's got lots of voiceover of Steve Martin kind of reminiscing, but most of it is contemporary to the time, archival footage. And then you get to part two of the documentary. And it's like a completely different movie. It's like a completely different approach. It is, the two segments are titled Then and Now. And it isn't like, oh, everything up to the end of his stand-up career in August of 1980. And then now let's start and tell the story of him doing movies and how that worked. You get that story in the second half, but that's not how it's presented. The first half is very chronological. It's stepping through this process. And then once that one ends and the next one begins, it really does go to now. And all of a sudden, the first shot is Steve Martin today, as we've seen him in Only Murders in the Building and, you know, things that he's doing right now. And the second half is stylistically completely different, functionally completely different, but it also offers this really interesting look at who he is and who he was through the period after 1980, but it does it through the prism of who he is now. And the first shot you get of the second movie is like now Steve Martin walking through his house and being like, oh, I'm doing a documentary. What are you guys doing here? It's really cool. There's lots of him interacting with Martin Short. They have become this comedy duo and are doing touring the country, doing stand-up dates, and obviously do Only Murders in the Building together. And it, you know, it talks about all the things that have taken up his life post 1980, his art collecting, his, you know, his playwriting, his banjo playing, his love life, his personal life. And he's such a private person that I haven't had any insight. He's, even as somebody who has ravenously read his autobiography, Born Standing Up, who I just love Steve Martin. I've been a huge fan. I wanted to do Picasso with the La Pina Gil for many, many years. I actually got cast as Elvis in that play and then couldn't do it. Anyway, I've been obsessed with Steve Martin, and I had no awareness of the sort of personal struggles that he's gone through. And this documentary is very open about that. He's very open about it. It talks about his life now where he's married and has a child, even in his, he's 76 now and has a young daughter, and talks about like fatherhood late in his life. So much really interesting stuff. I highly recommend this. Even if you're not as big a Steve Martin fan as I am, I think there's something really illuminating about a creative force of this magnitude opening their life up and being so honest about the struggles, the process. I mean, he was the biggest star on the planet. Mm-hmm. Then he went and made some of the most successful movies on the planet. And then he talks about this period where he thought he was a failure, you know, like that notion, everybody has ups and downs. There's no amount of success that will inure you from that level of self-criticism and, you know, dark moments. And it's, I think there's something very reassuring about that or comforting about it, that, you know, even this person whom I've looked up to my entire life, you see that nothing is easy and life has its ups and downs. And mm-hmm. there's some kind of beauty in seeing him in his mid 70s now really believing he's come to the happiest point of his life. And I don't know, I found that beautiful. I found the whole double documentary to be captivating, funny. There's, oh my God, there's so many incredible just bits that I hadn't seen of his that they show that had me laughing out loud. It's excellent.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this one, Jeff, so can't wait to check it out. Also, the idea, like his whole pivot is such a way to confront the innovator's dilemma thing, right? Like, which I think every creative person is often trying to deal with. So yeah, can't wait to check this out.
Yeah, first of all, Steve Martin has one of my favorite quotes of all time, which is, it's easy to be great, hard to be good. You know that quote, right?
Yeah.
I'll read it here. He says, this isn't Born Standing Up. Quote, it was easy to be great. Every entertainer has a night when everything is clicking. These nights are accidental and statistical. Like lucky cards in poker, you can count on them occurring over time. What was hard was to be good, consistently good, night after night, no matter what the abominable circumstances, end quote.
And he's still dealing with that. There's shots where he and Martin Short today, there's shots of them coming up off stage and having that exact discussion.
Mm.
It's really interesting.
I love that as an idea of how, like, sometimes it's going great. Everything's awesome. And then but the difficult thing is showing up week after week after 760 podcasts. I mean, whatever medium you're working in, you know, and still trying to be good. So I love that. I also am fascinated by, like, I just have had no exposure to Steve Martin's stand-up career. Like,
oh, when David, I was growing up. It.
And I love stand-up. I've, you know, bought many stand-up albums. I watch and listen to tons of stand-up. So, like, but when I was growing up, it was all, like, the Steve Martin movies, like Father of the Bride and stuff like that. That was how Steve Martin entered my, you know, sphere of knowledge.
Have you ever
and,
seen The Jerk?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You have?
The Jerk was, like, eye-opening for me, Jeff, because, like, I also grew up with, like, the Father of the Bride stuff. I went back and watched The Jerk, and that is just, like, a wild, raunchy movie.
Dude, The Man with Two Brains, All of Me. I watched All of Me on repeat as a little kid because I thought it was the funniest freaking thing I've ever seen. Oh, man. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, but anyway, so it's kind of like I feel like there's comedians who were relevant decades ago whose clips still show up often today. I'll say like George Carlin is one of them. Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor. Like these are comedians who like I still see their work in the popular consciousness. And it's weird that I just don't see that much of Steve Martin's old work in the popular consciousness.
I think he eclipsed himself. You know, new version of him. And there's an amazing moment in the documentary where they have a cassette tape. He finds this cassette tape of him doing bits. And he's like, I haven't listened to this in 40 years. And he puts it in and it's him, you know, doing stand-up. And he listens to it for like 30 seconds. He's like, I can't listen to this anymore. It's not who I am.
Yeah, and maybe that's why he doesn't like promote it. You know, he's not like out there being like, remember when I did this clip? You know, like he doesn't do any of that. He's active on social media. He doesn't do any of that stuff, right? Probably because of the reasons you say. So I think it's fascinating. I welcome the opportunity to kind of look back at some of his older material. And it seems like this documentary, Steve Martin, a documentary in two pieces, offers the chance to do that. So
I want to say one of my favorite jokes of his of all time. And if you'll indulge me,
all right.
There's a shot of him in a club, and he's standing behind the microphone, and he's like, you know, memory is a weird thing. It's like. Things that you think everybody would remember, nobody remembers. Like when the earth blew up. It's like nobody remembers that. You think a thing as big as the earth blowing up, everybody would remember, but it seems like nobody remembers. You remember that, you know, like when the earth blew up and we all had to go to this other planet and repopulate it, and the government was like, you know, we're not going to tell all the stupid people. Oh, wait. It's so brilliant.
Nice.
It's stuff like this, really avant-garde, weird. And then there's like this physical energy that he has that nobody was doing. I mean, we all know Jim Carrey. We all know, like, just nobody did what he was doing at that time. He could play stadiums because he was so large and physical that they didn't have screens like amplifying his image to the people in the back. It was just this little man on the stage, you know, hundreds of feet away, and his energy carried that stuff. It's an amazing thing to see.
All right, very cool. Well, it's Steve Martin, a documentary in two pieces. It's available right now on Apple TV Plus. That's another thing Jeff Cannata has been watching this week. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more what we'll be watching right after this. All right, folks, I had a chance to go see Ex Machina in IMAX this week. Have you guys heard that A24 is releasing a bunch of its movies in IMAX?
It's cool.
Was it just called IMAX Machina?
It's called A24 Ex IMAX. So, to take the Adam Wingard approach, A24 IMAX. But yeah, if you Google it, they have released Ex Machina.
If you in actually IMAX. Do his version, it's called IMA. Go ahead, Dave.
This is some of the worst material, Jeff.
On an episode where you're just like loving Steve Martin, Jeff. Like, this is what you're putting
on an episode with Steve Martin. How dare you?
How dare you?
All right. Anyway, so if you Google A24 IMAX, you'll see that Ex Machina played recently. Hereditary is going to be screening in IMAX on April 24th, and then Uncut Gems on May 22nd.
Oh, that's what you want. That's what you want to see on a 90-foot screen. Is like that anxiety storm.
Flop
Did
sweat.
They do anything to these movies to make them suited for IMAX?
Yeah, because I'm not that I'm aware of. And also, like, the thing is, I will say this, that like the certainly the way that Ex Machina was shot on, I believe, a Sony F65.
Yeah.
And so it has a very distinct digital look to it. And I don't think they like cleaned it up or did anything weird to it, because it looked very similar to how I experienced it in theaters and on video on demand afterwards. And I will also say Uncut Gems, that is a super grainy film. Like, I don't know like what that's going to be like in IMAX. But I guess... So I say all that to say I was quite skeptical going in that this would actually enhance my experience of watching Ex Machina. And I was wrong, as usual. I think it was actually quite a great experience to watch Ex Machina in IMAX. I will probably have some spoilers for Ex Machina here, but The big thing is that Ex Machina is a movie that won the Oscar for Best Visual Effects, and the visual effects still hold up, and they are incredible. And the biggest thing that's impressive about it is Ava is the machine. So it's about, for those who don't know what the movie's about, it's about this character who tries to test whether or not this machine that Oscar Isaac built, named Ava, can actually pass the Turing test and is actually, can pass for human. True artificial general intelligence. And the character of Ava is an incredible visual effect. And the reason she's incredible is because you can see through her. So, like, she has, like, some patches of cloth on her, but there's also, like, her lower torso. You can see through it into what is the space behind the character, right? That is very difficult to do. Vincenzo Natali once told me, recent guest on the Filmcast once told me, like, it's very easy to do visual effects that are additive, to, like, have a person's face and put barnacles on it, like in Pirates of the Caribbean or whatever, but much harder to do something that is subtractive, to, like, take something away. And that's what they achieve with the character of Ava. My understanding is they had to shoot every single scene that has Ava in it. They had to shoot it twice, right? They had to shoot it so that you just get the background, and then you have to shoot it with the actors in it. And that way, when they, like, digitally remove the chunks of her, you can see clearly. And I gained a greater appreciation of how difficult that was by watching Ex Machina in IMAX. The visual effects still look amazing. And that was a big takeaway from watching it in IMAX. It was like, oh, wow. Like, mm-hmm. I really, like, it's not the same as watching it on even a 65-inch television. It's like watching it so that, like, you know, the characters are 15, 30 feet tall. Like, mm-hmm. It really makes a difference to the viewing experience and really helped me appreciate the visuals more in this viewing. So
I have to say, Dave, sounds like you're on Team Front Row. This is what it's at. You don't have to go to IMAX to see a movie real big. You mm-hmm. just sit closer. Mm-hmm. But this is part of why I do that. This is such a genius move by A24, by the way. Like, they're such a merchandising storm. Like, they have a member. You can pay to be a member for A24 stuff, in which you pay to buy more stuff with A24 branding. So this is just, they don't even do anything to the movie, right? Just re-release it in IMAX. Brilliant. Love it.
I do think the movie continues to be awesome. I mm-hmm. still really love it. One of the things that sometimes when you watch a movie, there's certain aspects you appreciate more and more. One of the things that I appreciated a lot this time was Oscar Isaac's character's just complete disdain for Caleb, the Donald Gleason character. Like, every line is just kind of dripping with condescension, and he just doesn't think much of this other character, and that's suffused throughout the entire movie. Like, you don't really understand why until, like, you've watched the whole movie and you understand the ending. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was another thing that stuck out to me, was Oscar Isaac's performance.
Awesome. I want to point people, when that movie came out, I talked with Alex Garland about it. So I wrote that interview up at Engadget.
Nice.
So there's a lot of insight in there. We could have sat there for like 2 or 3 hours is the thing. Like, he is such an interesting guy to talk to. So yeah, glad this movie still holds up.
Well, It is sad because Alex Garland has been in the news recently. He gave an interview mm-hmm. to The Guardian this last week where he says that he is not planning to directing. He says, quote, "I'm not planning to direct again in the foreseeable future," end quote. He described himself as somebody who has fallen out of love with movies. Interesting interview to give 2 weeks before Civil War comes out, which is, by the way,
some amazing reviews. Yeah.
It has spectacular reviews, is tracking to be one of A24's most financially successful films of all time. And it's kind of a shame because this guy is a really interesting filmmaker. Like, whether you like him or hate him, he's making interesting stuff.
I hated Men.
Yeah, Men
but
was
I'm still like
Men
so
was
excited
the terrible,
for whatever
terrible
he has
movie,
going.
But like he's doing interesting stuff. He's one of the few filmmakers that is able to raise money for his movies out there.
Well, also we talk about like original concepts, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes when you say original, you just mean you just like rub the brand name of the franchise you're really trying to, you know, say, and just put something else on, like a call it Rebel Moon instead of Star Wars. But you could, these ideas are really original, truly original, like coming out of nowhere. And yeah, that's why I love it.
It would be
like,
a loss for him to never make another movie. That's for
exactly.
sure.
Yeah. Yeah, a loss to the culture for sure. But, also making movies is difficult. It's exhausting, you know, to be on set.
Looking at the trailer for Civil War made me exhausted. And I do wonder last time I talked with him, he was like, I'm going to do something about like exploring the idea of civil rights. I'm like, good luck, buddy. And now we have this movie. So yeah, I guess
I can understand this project being one that would break somebody.
Right, yes. I hope this is like a Steven Soderbergh style retirement where he makes like six movies in the next 5 years. That would be great. We'll see what happens. But anyway, Ex Machina, it was an IMAX. The other A24 movies will also be in IMAX in the next Hereditary and Uncut Gems. I had a great experience, so I can't speak for the other movies, but
sure.
Feels like they will probably be a good way to experience those movies as well.
This is kind of hilarious that the movies they chose do like two of the most like torturous cinematic experiences you can have. Like, let's put it on the biggest screen possible, right? Hereditary. I want to see those heads chopped off on the biggest screen possible.
It is weird. It is. I have to confess, it is a little bit weird. The movies they chose to release, like they didn't release like the most financially successful A24 movie. That would be like, I believe, Everything Everywhere All at Once and Lady Bird are the two most successful movies. So I'm like, I don't know why they didn't release those.
Yeah.
It's not like they released the movies that like look the most beautiful out of any movies that they so I'm baffled at the selections, but you know, none of them are bad films. So
we need more distributors like bringing back their old movies sometimes.
Absolutely.
That is good then.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Google A24 IMAX if you want to check out that series. Devinder Hardwar, hit us up with something you've been watching.
Sure. For this Easter weekend, I decided to check out Ken Russell's X-rated movie, The Devils.
Oh,
so, right. You know, I'm just celebrating.
We all celebrate differently.
We all celebrate. I saw this movie, which is also on the Criterion channel. And, you know, they should really just be paying us for all this shouting out. But this movie has been talked about for a while. Is it like a wildly orgiastic feature? Was banned in several countries, was banned, I think, in the UK for a long while until it was cut down. The version
I'm upset that you didn't recommend this to me instead of Sperm World, Devendra, based on what you just said.
I mean, so. I think I know what you're going to go to first. You know, you're going to go to the sperm first and then the nun orgy second. So this is my recommendation for the nun orgy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is a movie about a town in France where there's apparently, and this is based on the Aldous Huxley novel about the story of Loudun, where a lot of these events happened. Like there was a, let me see here. There was a cardinal that was trying to take over the town. And there was somebody, you know, one of the fathers, the Father Grandier, was the one trying to take care of the town himself. The cardinal was trying to take it over. And there's this whole group of nuns that are just kind of a little weird and a little sex obsessed. And this movie, I will not say I enjoyed it. It is a fascinating thing to watch, but maybe it's because the version I saw is pretty cut down too. The one on Criterion omits a huge sequence where the nuns just go crazy with like a statue of Christ, apparently. That is available on YouTube and elsewhere. So the cut down version does not make as much sense for whatever story they're trying to tell. But I will say this is a like gorgeous film to watch. It is wildly stylistic. We talk about directors like going places and doing crazy things. And Ken Russell certainly was doing that. This movie stars Vanessa Redgrave and Oliver Reed. And they're also just fascinating to watch. You know, it is almost cartoonish, like how overwrought and how melodramatic this movie can get at times. But to tell a story like this in 1971 and to do it so boldly and so uncompromisingly, you know, to the fact that so much of the world has banned it, I think there is something fascinating about that. So, yeah, I was more fascinated by this movie than entertained by it, but I am very glad I saw it. That's The Devils. It's on Criterion Channel. And, you know, if you do a little digging, you can find the fully uncut version. People have spliced in VHS copies or VHS segments of the scenes that were cut out, so it tends to look a little wonky. But it is a fascinating work of art. I'll say that.
All right, Jeff Cannata, take us home. What's one last thing you've been watching this week?
Well, I've been spending a lot of time on that Apple TV Plus, which, gents, I think has become my number two streaming service against all odds.
Behind?
Netflix.
Got it.
I think so. I think it might be number two for me. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Another new show has hit Apple TV Plus, and I have checked it out. It's called Palm Royale. Now, listen to this cast. Kristen Wiig, Allison Janney, Laura Dern, Josh Lucas, Julia Duffy, friggin' Carol Burnett, and Ricky Martin, baby. Ricky Martin, who... Vita can't be that loca because dude's 52 years old and looks amazing. He plays the freaking pool boy in this show and almost never has a shirt on or pants for that matter. He's just in like little Speedos. 52. He looks like he's 22. It's disgusting. I hate it. Anyway, Palm Royale is a show I have been thoroughly enjoying. I have watched three episodes so far. This is a show set in 1969. And the idea is that Kristen Wiig is a wannabe. She wants to be a member of this exclusive Palm Royale club, this very upper crust, hoity-toity supper club in Palm Beach, Florida. And she's just moved to town and she wants to desperately wants to be a part of it. But all of the highfalutin ladies who are, who are from old money and are just wealthy beyond belief and completely conceited and really horrible humans don't want her to be a part of it. And the show is about all the machinations she does to try to be part of this club. And I got to say, it's tough rooting for Kristen Wiig because her goals are, not very appealing in and of themselves. Like, she wants to be so much part of, I'm assuming by the end of the show, we're going to get to the realization that she doesn't want to be. She's not a nice person either. It's a bunch of horrible people being horrible to each other. But it's very delicious to watch. It is sumptuously made. The costumes alone, set in 1969, in the wealthiest part of the country with the wealthiest people flaunting their wealth as much as possible. There are many scenes where they literally just go to buy gowns to go to the various events that they're going to be held at this club. And they're just parading these amazing women parading in these absolutely to the nines, 1960s, gaudy, ridiculous dresses. It's worth watching just for the wardrobe. I tell ya. But the performances are also great. I love Kristen Wiig. She is, I'm saying, a tour de force performance here. Tour de force for Kristen Wiig. She is playing this wonderfully neurotic, strange character who, you know, comes from doing beauty pageants and just has this perspective of, you know, fake it till you make it. And don't ever admit to being anything less than what you are, what you want to be, I should say. And, but it secretly cries in her car alone, right? Because she's not who she wants to be. And it has some really wonderful twists and turns. Great cast. Like I said, great cast. I'm really enjoying Palm Royale. It's a kind of a guilty pleasure type show where you're just watching, you know, horrible, wealthy white people be exclusionary and awful to one another, but they all sort of get their comeuppance, right? That's the whole process of it, is just watching how awful they are to each other. And, set in this really hyper-real, vibrant Technicolor backdrop, it's good fun. I'm enjoying it very much.
All right, that's Palm Royale. It is on Apple TV Plus, and it is one other thing that Jeff Cannata has been watching this week. That's going to bring us to the end of what we've been watching. Let's do a few weekly plugs. Weekly plugs is a part of show each week where we plug something else we've been making. This week, I want to plug, we typically plug our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmpodcast. I want to plug a different Patreon page, patreon.com/DaveChen. I realized recently I have been recording a whole separate podcast over at patreon.com/DaveChen for the last couple of years. I've been publishing.
You just realized this.
I've published like bonus audio, you know, and then eventually you start publishing bonus audio so consistently that it essentially becomes its own podcast. So there's a whole podcast where I kind of give a behind the scenes look at all the stuff that I do online and talk about my reflections on stuff that's happening in the world, in media, and you know, on TikTok and things of that nature. And you can find all that at patreon.com/DaveChen. I also have a podcast called Dave on Dave, where I speak with publisher David Cho about his work. And that's also something you get when you subscribe to patreon.com/DaveChen. So thanks to everyone over there who's supporting my other more personal podcast at patreon.com/DaveChen. That is my weekly plug for the week. Devinder Hardwar, your weekly plug.
Oh, yeah. I joined Jason Kleberg over at the Force 5 podcast to talk about movie car chases, specifically the top five chases set in cities. And this was a fun conversation. He does like this is a podcast where you basically do a rundown of your top five things of whatever topic. And I chose chases within cities. I think you'll all appreciate the choices I made. I tried not to go for the most obvious ones. I wanted
Can
to
you
do
hit us
the,
up with one of the choices.
I mean, one of the choices, Ronin. I think Ronin, yes. The very like the Paris chase in Ronin is still one of the best ever put to film before we had a ton of like CG investing a lot of these chases too. So love that. And this was a fun chat. So check it out. The Force 5 movie podcast.
Jeff Cannata.
I do a video game podcast every single week. It's called DLC. The newest episode 541. We had Jarrett Green from IGN join us. And man, what a cool guy. Very, very insightful in his dissection of Dragon's Dogma 2, a big video game that just was released, and he wrote an in-depth review on IGN for. But hearing him talk about it and what he found compelling about this very strange game makes for great listening. A lot of really interesting other topics in this episode as well, including Marvel Rivals, the new Overwatch with Marvel characters that was just announced. Really good episode, I thought. And you can check it out at dlcpod.com.
Of course, I want to throw a shout out to patreon.com/filmpodcast. We got Molly and Max in the future coming up on After Arc this week. We got The First Omen coming up in the next couple of weeks. And you can support us at patreon.com/filmpodcast for ad-free episodes and exclusive After Darks. We never want anyone to donate if it in any way causes them financial hardship. You can only support us for free by leaving a star rating at Apple Podcasts or sharing about our podcast with your friends or on social media. Thanks to everyone who supports this podcast in any way. Let's get to our review of Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire.
For most of human civilization, we believed that life could only exist on the surface of our planet. What else were we wrong about?
Welcome to the Filmcast review of Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire. Yes, we're aware that you're supposed to pronounce the X silently, but we're not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. You guys can decide whatever you want to do.
Yeah, don't speak for all of us, Dave.
I've been pronouncing the X nonstop this whole time. You just haven't heard it because it's silent.
You've been whispering it under your breath.
It's a silent scream, this X.
According to the internet, here's a plot summary for the movie. Godzilla and the Almighty Kong face a colossal threat hidden deep within the planet, challenging their very existence and the survival of the human race. Before we get into this movie, I do just want to give a shout out to the fine creative folks over at Warner Brothers. This is the second movie that's premiered in the last couple months that has been a sequel to a movie that came out during the pandemic, that came out day and date with HBO Max. Remember Dune Part 1, Godzilla versus Kong? Both of those movies came out on HBO Max at the same time. They both still did relatively well at the box office, and then both of them had sequels come out within weeks of each other here in 2024, and they're both pretty massive hits. So bravo to keeping the theatrical film-going industry alive, and regardless of my thoughts on the movie, I am grateful that like these choices that they're making theatrically are being rewarded. All that said, why don't we start a little bit by talking about our thoughts on this MonsterVerse group of movies, which kind of the modern era started with Gareth Edwards' 2014 Godzilla, right? And we've had a bunch of MonsterVerse movies since then.
Monarch TV show,
yeah.
Don't forget
Monarch Legacy of Monsters TV show, right? Godzilla Minus One, not really part of the MonsterVerse.
Not at all part of it. So no, yeah. It's a whole separate verse. Yeah.
But what has been your overall thoughts on this movie and kind of your expectations leading into this one, Devinder Hardwar?
I mean, on this whole thing, like, I think it's been fascinating. Like, I remember being kind of into the original, the Gareth Edwards Godzilla, even though it was like narratively a mess, it looked amazing and had like really interesting vibes. Loved Kong Skull Island. I remember really liking the last one, you know, Godzilla versus Kong. A very simple title, very clean. You understood what was happening there. So I was down for it. I watched a couple episodes of Monarch too, and Monarch is cool. But just, you know, it didn't feel like there was much like to keep it going. But I love the idea of, like, I love big kaiju movies. I love Godzilla Minus One. Give me anything with Godzilla. Like, I will at least give it a shot. I did not really like this movie very much. Like, the sad thing is, like, I see glimpses of what I could, of what could be really enjoyable here. And this is just one of those movies where almost everything involving the humans just doesn't need to be there. Like, in fact, there are long stretches of this movie where there's no language or real dialogue. It's just, like, giant monsters fighting other giant monsters or trying to like come to realizations where it's just like monster noises, and that's kind of interesting and cool, and there's a really some cool storytelling happening there. But then you get back to Earth and you get back to Rebecca Hall and everything going on around her, and I just feel so displaced. Like, the only person I was really interested in this movie is Mr. Dan Stevens, who I think is doing the Lord's work in this movie. He probably the only human, him and who is it? Him and Brian Tyree Henry, I think, are the two characters or the two actors who know exactly the movie that they're in. But yeah, the Dan Stevens introduction alone, where the movie kind of jolts to life, the score gets some 80s synth going. He is like a wild guy. I'm gonna extract a tooth from Kong. That's my job. Just like the things that didn't work with the main character from, was it the Jurassic World movies, you know, whatever didn't work about Chris Pratt's characters there, yeah. Like everything I hate about that, this character is like another sort of wild, crazy adventurer, but kind of interesting, kind of kooky, kind of crazy. And I like it. So shout out to Dan Stevens for, you know, injecting some life into this thing. Whenever Dan Stevens shows up, I feel like you're in for at least a good time in the orbit of that character. So I appreciated that. But yeah, that's outside of the stuff happening in the Hollow Earth. Like I didn't really care much about any of the human stuff happening here. It just feels like it could have been tighter. It could have been tighter and maybe a little more focused. I see what they were going for. But I honestly was like struggling to stay awake through some of this movie, and that is never a good sign.
Jeff Cannata, what did you think about Godzilla X Kong, the New Empire?
Well, Dave, what I thought of Godzilla Kong, the New Empire.
Are you okay?
It's a mini stroke. Just a mini stroke. Yeah. It's okay.
Is best summed up in the form of a limerick. Godzilla gets into some scrapes. Kong starts some fights, then escapes. But this movie's a fail because it loses its scale when it's just a Planet of the Apes. See, I have kind of the opposite take from Devendra in a lot of ways.
But still disappointed, it sounds like. So.
Oh, it's terrible. I think we agree on that. Terrible, yeah. Yeah. Terrible movie. Yesterday, what happened to be Easter Sunday, and we were out and about with the kids. There's a thing in our neighborhood where they had face painting and you could meet the Easter Bunny and stuff. And so we're at the park, we're on the swings, and there's another parent came up to us and they said, oh, we're leaving early. I said, oh, why are you leaving early? Oh, I want to take the kids to go see Godzilla and Kong movie. and I went, oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, man.
And she's like, oh, what, really? I was like, oh, no, I feel bad doing that to you. You go enjoy. I'm sure it'll be fun. She's like, oh, yeah, my eight-year-old has been so excited for weeks. I'm like,
this is a movie made for eight-year-olds.
Yeah. So bad. I think this movie is so bad. And I feel like where I feel like I'm a little bit of the inverse from Devendra is that I feel like this is a monkey paw situation, or in this case, a giant ape paw.
Yes.
They're not called monkeys. That's rude, Jeff.
Yeah, sorry. Because I have been, over the last several weeks, going through and compiling all of my old limericks for the book that's coming out, Best Summed Up, the ultimate limerick quiz book. Film quiz book, which will, I think, be hitting stores hopefully by the end of the year. Maybe, I don't know. We'll find out. Anyway, I've been compiling all those, been going back through all my limericks and rewriting many of them because, boy, there's some bad ones. You guys never told me how bad they were. Why didn't you guys ever mention how
we were being kind, Jeff.
Such huge fans and like always congratulating me on how excellent they always were and never had any problems with the
the meter
syllable structure. Yeah, right. Never.
The rhyming, the approximate rhymes.
You guys, I don't understand. Anyway, I in that process read a number of my limericks for these really incessant Kong and Godzilla movies that have been coming out. There's a lot of them. The lyrics have only been going on, what, 3 or 4 years tops? And I think there's like 3 or 4 Kong limericks in there.
Yeah.
Anyway, the overwhelming takeaway I got from those limericks, revisiting them, is that I kept wanting less humans, more monsters fighting each other. The first few of these movies is like a half an hour of the giant monsters and an hour and a half of the humans. And I feel like Kong, Godzilla, whatever it's called, this one really gave me what I wished for. There are, as Da Vinci pointed out, large stretches of this movie where there is nothing that has been physically photographed. It is just CG monster in front of CG environment.
Jeff,
smacking.
I think you mean shot on location in Hollow Earth. Come on.
No, shot on location in Hollow Earth. I stand corrected. Pardon me.
Thank you.
But there's a lot of big things smacking other big things, which is what I said I wanted. And now here I am on the other end of this monkey paw situation going, I've made a terrible mistake.
I've made a huge, tiny mistake. Yeah.
Because there's no Frogert. With the, you know what I'm saying?
Well, you're saying there's no scale, and I
there's
agree,
no
I
scale.
Kind of agree
well, that's
there.
The biggest problem. Yeah. Is that what's fun about Godzilla and King Kong is holy smokes, they're bigger than the tallest skyscraper. They can just smash walk right over it. And there are a couple of scenes in this movie. There's one in Egypt that is. It's like, oh, that's a clever idea to put them there.
And there's stuff in Rome that I think the Godzilla stuff has scale because he's on Earth, you know,
right. Barely
topside.
A couple of moments. But most of what happens is big stuff fighting other big stuff in big land. Yeah. And it really does just look like Planet of the Apes, which is a far better franchise, far better films. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited for the next one. But you completely lose that immensity that is the selling point of the giant kaiju is that they're giant and you lose that. And I was really racking my brain. I've been racking my brain for days since I saw this movie going, what is fundamentally wrong with the action here? Hmm. Because I'm not going to oversimplify it and say, oh, it's just CGI thing smacking other CGI thing. I think it's a lazy critique.
There is a critique there though. It can't work, but the CGI here is weightless. It is kind of like it is not grounded. Yeah.
Let Jeff finish. You it seemed like you had an answer for that, right?
Well, I find myself thinking about, for example, The Way of Water, right? Where it's just CGI things attacking other CGI things as far as the eye can see, right? And yet that action felt so intense, edge of my seat, incredible, right? It's not simply the fact that the visual effect makes it somehow unwatchable or less than. There is something fundamental about what is happening here, how it's shot, how it's presented, how it's dramatized, whether I care about these creatures. And there's so much effort in Godzilla X Kong to really make Kong a protagonist, specifically Kong. I mean, Godzilla, not as much. Kong is really, we are supposed to be inside his thoughts moment to moment. He has little comedic sidekicks and things like that. It's pathetic, frankly, but there's a lot of effort to humanize him, to give you pathos and see inside his mind and really associate with that character. And I found it to be almost completely a failure and almost completely pandering and ridiculous and not at all interesting or fun. And then when the movie does get bombastic and loud, I mean, it's amazing that Da Vinci could fall asleep at all. This movie is, I saw it in IMAX and it was very loud.
Snoozing during loud parts is the thing, which is sad.
It does do the Transformers thing where the giant things smack into each other a lot, but I could not for the life of me get any sense of investment. I didn't care. None of it was cool. None of it felt fun. Mm-hmm. None of it felt inventive. There's some neat things that happened. Like you can see on the page, like, oh, that is a neat idea. But in execution, it almost never felt dramatic or interesting. There's no tension created. It is a flat experience from start to finish for me. And it's such a shame because there's so much money on the screen. There's these big iconic characters that you think it should matter when they start facing off against each other, but it is so insipid. It's mm-hmm. so bland. It's so lowest common denominator that I just had absolutely no fun with this movie. And I want to say one other quick thing before you go, Dave. And that is, people who have listened to the show a long time know that for a while I have been tickled. And there's a little kernel of joy, and I bring it up frequently. Every time there's someone in a movie who has my job, because it's kind of wild that, like, here I was doing this job that no one knew about. I had to try to talk my parents, like, well, how do I tell my friends what you do for a living? I'm like, well, there's this way to get audio on the internet, and you can listen to. And then all of a sudden, it became mainstream. And now, then there was all these people in movies that, you know, Steve Martin and Martin Short do my job on a TV series. It's kind of exciting. They do my job. That's cool. Well, I'm here to tell you, fellas.
Yes, I know exactly what you're
saying. We've come out the other side. We've come out the other side. And now we've reached the place of oversaturation of the podcaster. There was this thing that happened in like the late 80s, late 90s, early 2000s, mm-hmm. where every movie had to have like the nerdy computer guy.
The internet man.
Yes. Because the internet was such a crazy thing to introduce to a mainstream audience. Right, they had to have the weird dude that lived in the basement that the main character had to go consult. And then they would say things like, say it again in English, please. Mm-hmm. You know? That character is alive and well in today's cinema, ladies and gentlemen, but now it's a podcaster.
And it's done, like, listen, my complaints about Only Murders in the Building, even more true here, because here's a podcaster who we were looking at his setup, you know, his desk setup, his camera, or his microphone, way all over in the corner. he's podcasting. He's talking to his monitor way over in the corner. This is a guy who's producing content for the internet, going into Hollow Earth, going to like a once-in-a-lifetime trip into the Hollow Earth. Not recording anything, not shooting any footage, not doing anything.
Well, he's shooting
footage on a mini DV camera.
It makes no sense at all.
None of this makes sense.
It is now podcaster is shorthand for exposition that mm-hmm. we know you're bored by, but there's these weirdos that are super into it. So let's just throw this stock character that used to be the internet guy. And I'm sure there was a version before that of whatever it was, but it was ever thus, and now it is us. And hated it in this movie.
Let's put an Oscar-nominated actor in that role, too. Like, let's just really degrade this person of immense talent. To what you're saying, Jeff, like, I do think it really does come down to scale around the CG stuff, because I do remember seeing the Gareth Edwards Godzilla, and the trailers for that were fantastic. Like, they opened with, like, ominous chanting music and people skydiving and seeing Godzilla in the background. And scale was always what he sold. He even sold that really well in The Creator. I think that's one of the, you know, few things that worked in that movie. And Adam Wingard does not get the scale. He gets toys, right? So Godzilla versus Kong, I think they were more like action figures. And there's fun. There's fun in that. I really enjoyed Kong using fighter jets like ninja stars. Like, that was fun. But again, that was topside. You had stuff to like relate the proportion of like how big they were. You're right. When they go to Hollow Earth, we just kind of lose that.
It's completely gone.
And the CG itself is just not that great too. Like, it is weightless. Even Godzilla, when he is topside, moves too quickly. And also it doesn't make sense. Like, the amount of damage he does compared to what he is trying to solve. Like, again, I still don't understand how that balances out.
There's millions of people that meet their doom in this movie, and no one mentions a single word.
It's just Godzilla walking through town. Millions
and we just
die.
Saw it. We just saw Godzilla Minus One.
Yep.
We just saw this like perfect template of how you make both the effects of Godzilla compelling and overwhelming and immense and amazing. Mm-hmm. And the people having weight and matter and caring about their stories. Like, the movie did it. And here's this movie that I'm sure had a budget of 12 times as much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you could do it by making Godzilla the villain. Like, it's when Godzilla becomes the buddy is where the math just doesn't quite work out among this. How many innocents is he killing to just like recharge from a nuclear reactor or something?
Yeah. Yeah. I actually wrote an entire blog post about this phenomenon you're discussing, Jeff Cannata, over at decodingeverything.com, about why doesn't it look right when they move around in this movie? And there is this video I saw by a YouTube channel called Kurzgesagt that explained why things are the size they are, right? And why things behave the way they behave, which is that, like, to give an extremely short version of it, as things get larger, their volume increases dramatically, but their surface area does not. And you need surface area, aka skin, to radiate out the heat that you're producing as a larger creature. So that's why when you have a massive creature like an elephant, that heartbeat its heartbeat's like, you know, 30 times a minute, as opposed to a chipmunk, which can beat like 350 times a minute, right? And we all understand this implicitly. Like, when we see a chipmunk, its heart's beating and moving around real fast, like, we get it. We get why that's the case. And we also get why when there's a massive thing, it's moving super slowly. And the reason that Godzilla X Kong the New Empire breaks your brain is because you have ginormous things moving super quickly.
Yes.
And that just doesn't make any sense. It's like when you watch Gareth Edwards' Godzilla, you are watching creatures that were the size of apartment buildings move around, and their movements are deliberate and they're slow, and every movement is purposeful because you only get a few if you're that big. And in this movie, they literally could be human-sized beings. Like, they literally could, they're like jogging, they're jumping.
Godzilla's, you know, jogging by the end.
Well, right. Also because everything they're fighting is proportional to them.
Exactly, exactly. And you see, because they spend so much time on Hollow Earth, you see there's very little time. I'm going to say less than 5 minutes where you see human, or maybe less than like 15 minutes, where you see humans in relation to these creatures.
Or human, even human constructions.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that is one of the biggest appeals of watching these movies,
exactly,
is like seeing those things interact with human structures, human beings. And that's where this movie is, I think, a huge miss, is because it is easy to go to a theater and watch CG things punching other CG things. Mm-hmm. That is easy to see. It's almost every other movie. But having creatures of this size and scale is a little bit rarer, you know, when you're not watching Ant-Man increase the massive size in a Marvel film. Like,
well, he always moves very slowly too.
There you go. There you go. And so
I think to put it even finer point on what you're saying is, I don't think Kong would have been as much a film icon if he hadn't been perched on the Empire State Building.
Yeah.
Throwing planes, right? That's the image. The image isn't, hey, it's a big monkey. You know, it's a big ape. It's oh my gosh, it's on something that we all know is enormous.
Yes, yes, exactly.
There's that. I mean, everything Spielberg laid down in Jurassic Park just kind of is the template that a lot of big movies featuring big creatures should be following. And I don't know, what do we blame? The Transformers movies to like make massive things that move too quickly? Like, I think it is ultimately that, even though I like the first Transformers.
Well, I think this is an example of feature creep.
Yeah.
In a feature, because it's like, by the time we're at this movie, it's like, well, what do we got to get them? We got to up the ante, we got to up the ante, and to the point of ridiculousness. And it just, nothing has any meaning anymore. Now we got to see him do all this crazy stuff. And like, we got to see Kong, you know, throw an axe onto the side of a cliff and scale down it like freaking, you know, I don't even
know. He's in like SEAL Team 6 or something like that,
exactly.
Basically, right?
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. But, you know, hey, I do also want to acknowledge that these characters have had a long history. And, you know, for many, many years, Godzilla was a dude in a suit fighting other dudes in suits. And like, and that also looked ridiculous in its own way, right? But I will say that was a lot more charming than what we're seeing here, right? There's a charm to the fact that you're seeing a physical human actually do the thing.
Yeah.
This movie, the action scenes don't work for me at all. The human characters are a complete waste. I will say the one character that I was like, oh, I really felt like this could have been interesting is exploring more Gia's relationship with Kong, right? That's a cool idea, is that this one character has a connection with this other massive creature that no other character can replicate. Of course, it's completely underserved in this movie. And instead, we get a bunch of Kong, we get a bunch of Godzilla lore in this movie, a bunch of lore that happens, and a bunch of these kind of weightless action scenes. Dan Stevens is always cool. I'm going to be honest with you. I literally didn't remember that Rebecca Hall was a major character in this franchise.
Same.
She was
the major character.
Yeah, she was like one of the major main characters in Godzilla versus Kong.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, this movie was a miss for me. And I'm bummed because there was a lot of opportunity to make something that felt more weighty and substantive. And it seems like that wasn't taken. So,
yeah.
Anyway. There's a few spoilers that I think are worth mentioning, so let's get to them. Spoilers for Godzilla X Kong the New Empire starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth!
Inconceivable!
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
All right, let's talk about a few of the spoilers. First of all, they show up. I think it's a huge bummer to me that there was this relationship between Kong and this smaller ape, smaller giant ape called Suko, or I think his name is Suko. It's never said out loud or anything in the movie, as far as I can recall. And that was kind of interesting to me. I was like, oh, this could be cool. Very Planet of the Apes-esque.
Yes.
But it's like, this could be cool, but it's given so little time that I don't think it really has a chance to develop. Unfortunately, we spend so much more time dealing with the humans and their pointless issues. But I did want to acknowledge, that's kind of a cool idea of King Kong having like a disciple. Also, we have no idea how tall that small ape is in relation to humans. That kind of sucked.
The scale is like, even if you're shooting something in an all CG creation, like Kong scaling down the cliffs, make the cliffs look bigger. Just pull back a bit so we can see a lot of this stuff. It's the way they visualize Hollow Earth, I think, is also very empty. Mm-hmm. That kind of
deals
with a lot of this issue.
I agree. Anyway, they have. Oh, one thing I will say that's kind of cool about the movie is Mothra shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Mothra not in any of the promotional materials for this movie, so that's a cool little surprise.
Surprise.
And you know, Mothra kind of helped out a little bit. And I thought Mothra has a really cool design in this movie as well.
Yes.
So anyway,
at that
point,
it was like, who gives a shit?
Well,
I
think they were seeding the whole telepathic to Kong thing in the last movie. So it's like, I feel like that Mothra was in the original Godzilla movies. There were like telepathic kids, right, who were like calling Mothra. So I feel like that was seeded. It's a cool design, but they don't really do much with it. It's a shame. Like, I look at
Mothra
this movie
comes
and
in and helps out a little bit, and then that's it. You know.
Well, he's more like, "Hey guys, stop fighting. We had a whole other movie about this. You fought. Now we're supposed to work together.
Yeah.
Don't forget."
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Godzilla and Kong just start fighting for no reason, as if they did not just try to. You know, they had a big adventure a couple of years ago. Totally forgot that. I guess.
I think that the only part of the movie that I actually, well, that's not true. I think the very end with the gravity stuff was kind of clever and like could have been cool in an alternate version of this movie.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, Godzilla kneeing his way through the pyramids of Giza is a pretty cool image. You know, it's a waste in this movie, but I do think, hey, we've seen them smash through countless skyscrapers. Mm-hmm. Let's smash through something else that's iconic.
Well, he's sleeping like a cat in the Colosseum, too. And every time he leaves, he destroys more of the Colosseum. It's more like Godzilla doesn't give a fuck, right? Yeah, Godzilla, he's like, I gotta deal with these big monsters. There are people in the way. You are like ants to me. I'm just going to walk right
systematically
through.
Going through all of the wonders of the world.
Yeah.
The thing that was a real bummer was when Godzilla was swimming out of there and he just started taking out those bridges with his little his little fins on the back.
Too
and
soon.
I was
like, too soon.
Dude, guys, I mean, those bridges take a lot of work to build.
And I wonder if there was any conversation of like the news right before this.
I'm sure there was conversation. It was like,
it's like, and the thing is, Godzilla, he didn't have to do that. He could have just swam a little bit lower and then it would have been
Godzilla just doesn't care.
He doesn't give a fuck. He doesn't care. Godzilla, dude.
It's like, I was here before your puny civilization. I will be here after you are gone.
Yeah.
I just so hated the establishment of you know, a Bizarro Kong and Bizarro Godzilla. And it just felt so obvious and lame the way we're going to have an evil Kong and an evil Godzilla for them to fight. And there was a moment before they introduced Scar or whatever dumb name he's got. I'm sure it's like something like Scar.
Scar
it
King.
Is Scar.
Scar
yeah.
King.
I yeah, believe. Of course it is. When you see him in silhouette and there was that, he had that, you know, that spine around his shoulders when he comes walking out, and for a split second, I was like, oh shit, is Godzilla X Kong? Is he like a hybrid Godzilla Kong bad guy? Was he like, they mated and they created some weird ape lizard thing that would have been, and he walks out. It's like, no, it's just a, just
you're,
another
you're right
ape
up my alley though, Jeff. You want to see Godzilla and Kong mate? Like you just want that to happen. They
get it
kiss.
On. Anyway, I thought that was
here's
a
my question.
Opportunity. It was all of the all of the Planet of the Apes garbage. All of the stuff of like, hey, he's been looking for someone who else like him, and oh wait, they were right over here the whole time. It's so dumb.
Yeah,
so
it's
dumb.
It's a very. It reminds you of this other movie series that is way, way, way better. Than
way
this
better.
One. And in fact, there's a new movie coming, and maybe we should refresh ourselves on that.
Yeah, perhaps. The thing that I was curious about is they show up at Scar King's lair, and you find out he has enslaved a whole fleet of Kong-like apes.
And needs them to mine for some reason, I guess?
Like, what is he doing? What are they doing?
What are they doing?
What it's is just he like building? The most
what is
boring,
he building?
The boring, obvious metaphor for subjugation. We'll have the mining shit. Why? Who cares? Mining seems oppressive. It's like imagination whatsoever.
What were they building? Was that ever explained what he was building?
No, like, not at all.
He's not building anything.
Maybe he has that cool ass whip sword thing, which has the power to control the other, you know, Godzilla, the other.
Also not explained.
That was kind of a cool idea.
That's a cool weapon.
And I thought that kaiju was pretty cool design and everything like that.
So I was thinking like, are they just these subjugators? They were looking for more power, right? He's looking for more things like that. But the movie doesn't give us any of that.
Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah. And then, of course, the Rebecca Hall and her daughter kind of decision at the end.
God.
Pretty.
Well, all of the stuff.
Jeff,
about
I can't
this...
tell. Did you like this movie?
Sorry. All of the stuff about the secret Hollow Earth people that have been there and somehow manipulate gravity and don't talk but can communicate telepathically. It's a bad episode of Star Trek original series, you know?
That's what it is. Did you enjoy the Volkswagen ad, Jeff?
Yeah, I did. Let's get the car.
That has been
perfectly
clipped.
Composite
perfectly.
Volkswagen.
Literally an ad shot of that car, but that's been going around Twitter. Yeah. I didn't know what they were talking about before I saw that clip. So like, okay.
Yeah, it was.
I felt bad for Dan Stevens. I was like,
I feel bad for Rebecca Hall. I don't feel bad for Dan Stevens because he is having fun. Rebecca Hall does not get to have fun in this movie, unfortunately.
That's the thing with Rebecca Hall. I think she is such a talented actor, you know, and I feel like she has just appeared in movie after movie that has not made use of her skills. Like I want to say like the last movies that I can remember.
Resurrection.
Yeah, Resurrection was great.
We talked about that.
We talked about that on the podcast. The Town, she was pretty good in The Town, even though that was
how far back are we going? That's
pretty
that
far.
Was 2010. I thought you saw it in The Gift. You know, the
Gift is good.
And also I heard Nighthouse was good. Basically all her small movies are good. Like
all her small movies.
The small movies she and then she makes a movie like Godzilla X Kong, probably so she can make the small movies.
She was great in Tales from the Loop, which not many people saw, but that was also fantastic. Yeah. It's really between Christine and Resurrection, like that is like what she is very good at.
Yeah.
Being the centerpiece of a large monster movie franchise, not so much. It's unfortunate.
She's fine in this. Yeah. I don't think she's bad.
Fine.
It's just like there's
she's not bringing
there's nothing for
to
her
it.
To do. Yeah. Right. Nothing for her to do in this movie other than, hey, my daughter is kind of not fitting in. And at the end of the day, we're still going to be together. And that's wonderful. You know, so
I got to go talk to the podcaster because he'll know what to do about my daughter.
That's so true of life in general. You know, it's like
the amount of times people come knocking at my door while we're recording. And I'm like, please,
please,
I can't solve all your problems. I'm merely a podcaster.
My daughter is making drawings that look suspiciously like what high tech seismic equipment is picking up.
Yes. Wait,
by the way,
you need to travel from the Caribbean to Miami to show squiggly lines to any eye.
That was a stretch. That was a stretch, right? She drew three peaks. And look, there's three peaks in this thing. Like, I mean, okay, but like really? Also,
it looks are we really going to risk our life? Are we really going to risk our life on this hunch? Is that really?
He takes one look at it. And he's like, yeah.
It's the same thing.
You know, it's the same thing of any three peaked, you know, any drawing of two, three triangles. It's not exactly the freaking, you know, I don't know, Mona Lisa or whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Anyway,
it's not the freaking Rosetta Stone.
Speaking of another reboot franchise, you know, with a podcaster, I still like what Carrie Coon was doing in Ghostbusters Afterlife and the new one. Not as much; she wasn't in as much, but she at least was bringing something to it. And I wish there was room for Rebecca Hall to be a little weird, be a little fun,
that
be a little.
That
flip.
Movie franchise actually has a character named podcast.
Yeah, now he's just cast.
How far
now
we've
he's
come.
Older?
Yeah, wow, progress, folks,
progress. Yeah.
All right, at the end of the day, Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, not a movie that any of us particularly liked, a real missed opportunity. And I have to
and
say,
there's going to be more of them.
Yeah, because this movie is a huge success. This is the thing. This is the thing, guys. This is what I struggle with on a daily basis, is my own creeping irrelevance in society. Because
creeping or sprinting?
Now dealing with because this movie is a massive success and people love it. It has an A- cinema score, and probably whatever the hell they did in this movie is probably the near, if not far, future for what this franchise is.
I mean, for the 8-year-old who is going to see it during the day, like, should be a lot of fun. I was half considering trying to go during the day and bring my kid. I was like, oh, not yet. Maybe 8. She's currently 5, and the opening scene involves a massive fight and King Kong tearing apart the carcass of another giant animal.
That's true. He does bathe in its blood.
Does bathe in its green blood. It can't be red, but you know. Yeah. Do want to shout out Junkie XL? I think does the score for this movie.
Score is
at
awesome.
Times.
The score is
at
awesome.
Times. Yeah, it leaps to life, especially when like the Dan Stevens stuff is happening.
Yeah.
Like at times it decides to just be 80s synth, and I'm like, oh, that's fun.
Yeah,
let's have more fun in this movie. Yeah,
love the score in this film. So anyway, all right. Well, despite everything we've just said, at the end of the day, it is really impressive that Adam Wingard made a movie. And that's going to bring us into this week's episode of The Filmcast. You can find more episodes at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Find us across all platforms at The Filmcast Pod. Tim McEwen is the person who wrote our theme song, our spoiler bumper, and weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode. And next week on the podcast, it's going to be Monkey Man. Monkey Man.
Wait a minute. Oh, yeah. Wasn't that this movie? No? I'm sorry. Monkey Man, X Godzilla, right?
Going out on a strong note, Jeff Cannata. But Monkey Man, a movie that had a very tumultuous making of. I'm really excited to talk about it right here on the podcast. Yeah. Should be a fun time. Until then, thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the podcast. We'll see you later.